Gregory Baldwin, Officer Jordan Winkle, and those are the officers that arrested me that day and stopped me.
And what are you hoping will come out of this?
I'm hoping that the officers will get fired and I get compensation for what was done to me. And I just want justice for what happened to me and for all the injustices in this city that have been pushed up under the rug. That's why I'm fighting so hard, because I'm not just fighting for myself. I'm fighting for Aaron Campbell, Keaton Otis, Kendra James, James Chassie, and many others that don't have a voice right now.
Those all being people that died at the hands of the Portland police.
Yes.
Do you feel that there's a connection between the Department of Justice's finding that the Portland police use excessive force in certain situations and your situation?
Yes, I do. It happens a lot. They're covering up for each other. IA, Internal Affairs, the DOJ, the police chief, they're all in it together. And right, I believe after my CRC hearing, the former chief of police, he resigned. He retired.
Do you think that had something to do with your case?
I feel that it did, because he retired after this happened, you know, and he exonerated them. And he's part of my lawsuit, Chief Reese.
Are you asking for people to come out in support of your lawsuit against the Portland police?
Yes. To stand with me and the injustices in the city. If they're tired of the injustices in the city, they need to show up at my trial tomorrow and support me. This is a 3-day trial. It's very serious.
So where should people come if they are interested in showing that support?
It's going to be held in the federal U.S. District Court in downtown Portland, Oregon, room 14B.
So that's 9 a.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, December 9th, at the federal courthouse. And what room number?
14B.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Lisa. And I do hope that you achieve some justice in this case.
Yes. Thank you, Jinka, for having me on this show and allowing me to get my story out.
And again, we've been speaking with Lisa Haynes, who's been brutalized by the Portland police and is now filing a lawsuit against them. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Listening to KBOO Portland. It is 6:05, and the programming today is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from RadioCab. RadioCab, serving the metro area since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. RadioCab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212, in Vancouver at 360-694-1234, or radiocab.net. Programming is also made available by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide and openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones, Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. And this is KBOO Radio, and coming up next we have This Way Out, Queer News Around the World.
Murdered people by pushing them off the rooftops of buildings, by stoning people to death, by shooting people. And more recently, we've been hearing stories from colleagues in Iraq and Syria that some ISIS agents have actually been tying weights around the neck of people they intend to execute for alleged homosexual acts so that they're sure that when they push them off the building, it will be their head that hits the ground first.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Ireland bans bias against queer school teachers, Austrian kids sue for their parents' marriage rights, and Syrian refugees are not all created equal. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the 2 weeks ending December 5th, 2015. Members of the lower house of Ireland's parliament voted on December 2nd to effectively ban schools in the country, most of which are owned and operated by the Roman Catholic Church, from discriminating against LGBT teachers and other employees. the Senate had already approved the amendment to the Employment Equality Act. It removes exemptions that had allowed schools and hospitals to take action to prevent employees from undermining the religious ethos of the institution. Sandra Irwin-Gowron of the Gay and Lesbian Equality Network said the change removes what she called the chill factor and will now allow LGBT people to be themselves, get married, and have a family without a threat to their job if they work in a religious-run institution. Passage of the amendment this week caps off a wonderful year for LGBT rights in the Republic of Ireland. In May, Irish citizens made theirs the first country in the world to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples through a voter referendum.
Meanwhile, lawyers for two same-gender couples in Northern Ireland, who are stuck in less than equal civil partnerships, argued in a landmark legal case at the High Court in Belfast this week that the government's refusal to endorse a marriage equality bill constitutes state discrimination. They said the intransigence is having a corrosive impact on society. Government lawyers basically argued that civil partnerships meet basic international human rights requirements. The judge says he expects to issue his ruling after Christmas. Civil marriage is already open to same-gender couples in England, Wales, Scotland, and the Republic of Ireland.
Despite strong opposition from the country's Orthodox Church, lawmakers on the Mediterranean island of Cyprus voted 39-12 on November 26th to create civil unions for lesbian and gay couples. Joint adoption rights, however, were pointedly not part of the bill. Nevertheless, the European region of ILGA, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association, applauded the first-ever legal recognition of same-gender couples in the country. Cyprus has been under pressure to improve its LGBT rights legislation since it joined the European Union in 2004. The capital city of Nicosia hosted its first-ever LGBT Pride March just last year.
Meanwhile, lawmakers in the Australian state of Queensland voted 64-22 this week to restore civil unions for both same-gender and heterosexual couples. They were created by a Labour government in 2008 and had even allowed an official marriage-like ceremony, but they were downgraded to registered relationships in 2012 by the Liberal Nationals, who also removed same-gender couples' ability to have children through surrogacy. LGBT rights advocates lauded the restoration, but continue their push for full marriage equality.
The Supreme Court of Bermuda ruled on November 27th that foreign same-gender spouses legally married to the Caribbean island's gay and lesbian citizens are entitled to the same residency and employment rights as their heterosexual counterparts. Chief Justice Ian Kowali supported a group of bi-national plaintiff couples in the lawsuit against government officials. He said of current law in his ruling that the direct discrimination was self-evident and quite obvious, and no coherent counterargument was advanced by lawyers for the Minister of Home Affairs and the Attorney General. Kowali gave the government 2 weeks to appeal his ruling.
And as the Monty Python gang might say, now for something completely different. Five children with lesbian and gay parents are suing for their mom's and dad's civil marriage equality in Austria. The country grants equal parenting rights to same-gender couples, including second-parent adoption, joint adoption, and medically assisted conception, but not equal marriage rights. Dr. Helmut Graupner is representing the families and says the children deserve the legitimacy that the civil marriages of their parents would bring them. Vienna's child and youth advocate seemed to agree, saying in a statement this week that civil marriages of the parents would ensure that their children's rights are fully respected and help them feel confident about their family stability. Graupner told online news outlet The Local that he expects a ruling in January or February.
But lawmakers in Uganda continued their apparent crusade against sexual minorities with passage on November 26th of a bill that closes foreign aid groups if government officials object to their activities. Human rights advocates warn that the legislation is a less than veiled attempt to expel LGBT-supportive non-governmental organizations, NGOs, even though their work often involves HIV/AIDS education. The NGO bill requires all foreign aid organizations to be licensed. A license would be revoked if the NGO has been involved in any act which is prejudicial to the interests of Uganda and the dignity of the people of Uganda. Directors of groups operating without a license could be fined and imprisoned for up to 8 years. The language in the bill seems to be purposely vague and allows the government to virtually expel any NGO it doesn't like. Critics say the new law also opens the door to the persecution of peaceful political opponents.
In other news, lawmakers in Vietnam voted 282-84 on November 24th to allow trans people who've undergone reassignment surgery elsewhere to re-register in their gender of choice. The operation is illegal in Vietnam, so trans people seeking the surgery usually travel to nearby Thailand. Those who qualify will still have to wait until early 2017 before the legislation takes effect. The new law is nevertheless another advance for sexual minorities in the Southeast Asian nation, which boasts a burgeoning and vibrant queer nightlife in its main cities and even bicycling pride processions in Hanoi in recent years. Vietnamese LGBT rights activists are setting their sights now on making gender reassignment surgery legal in the country.
Bolivia's Justice Minister Virginia Velasco Condori issued an administrative order on November 27th, allowing trans people to legally change their name and gender designation on official government documents, including IDs and birth certificates. Individuals will need to be psychologically evaluated first, however. It took a while. The action was first proposed 3 years ago by Raisa Toriani, the national coordinator of the Bolivian trans movement.
Updating some previous NewsWrap reports, Mona Iraki, the infamous Egyptian TV journalist who orchestrated a televised raid on a Cairo gay bathhouse last December, was sentenced on November 26th to 6 months in jail for defamation and spreading false news. 26 men, including the bathhouse owner and four employees, were tried for debauchery, but exonerated due to lack of evidence. Iraki remains unrepentant despite worldwide criticism. A lawyer for the men said they intend to sue her for damages in civil court.
And the board of directors of a Rutherford County, North Carolina public charter school has reversed its ban on student clubs 2 weeks after it suspended all of them, including the school mascot-based Raptors for Christ, rather than allow an LGBT student group to meet on campus. A supportive teacher allowed the fledgling lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender club to meet in her classroom. When word got out, most people at a raucous public meeting expressed everything from disapproval to outrage. A news release from the American Civil Liberties Union this week said the board of Lake Lure Classical Academy, which offers classes from kindergarten to high school, voted on November 30th to establish a new policy requiring students up to and including eighth grade to get parental consent to join a student club, but not its high school students. The Associated Press reported that the board will also now require all club posters to have a stamp of approval from the school director and restricts them to designated club bulletin boards in the middle and high school halls.
And finally, cozying up to advocates of executing gay people and the farthest right wing of his party hasn't seemed to hurt GOP presidential hopeful Ted Cruz. In the latest poll of rank-and-file Republicans, the Texas senator has surged to second place in the crowded pack of GOP presidential wannabes, though he's still behind entrenched frontrunner Donald Trump by double digits. In a conference call with conservative activists this week, Cruz called the Supreme Court marriage equality ruling
one of the greatest threats to our democracy we have seen in modern times.
He also condemned President Barack Obama for being
more interested in promoting homosexuality in the military than he is in defeating our enemies.
The senator teetered on parody in the face of tragedy this week, just hours after Robert Louis Deere attacked a Planned Parenthood facility in Colorado Springs, killing three people and injuring nine others.
I think there has been some vicious rhetoric on the left blaming those who are pro-life. We don't fully know the motivations of this deranged individual. We know that he was a man who registered to vote as a woman. You know, the media promptly wants to blame him on the pro-life movement when, at this point, there's very little evidence to indicate that. It's also reported that he was registered as an independent and as a woman and a transgender leftist activist, if that's what he is.
After Cruz's comments went viral, a spokesperson admitted that the senator's news source had been a right-wing blog. A Think Progress reporter concluded that the voter registration form identifying Deere as female, the only accuracy among Cruz's claims, was probably nothing more than a typo. And a BuzzFeed reporter sent to Deere's hometown of Hartselle, Colorado, spoke with six people who said they knew him and that there was no indication that he might be transgender. One neighbor described Deere as a rough-looking giant dude.
That's News Wrap for the 2 weeks ending December 5th, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Is there any escape from the Islamic State?
We had documented over 30 killings in Iraq and Syria in 2015 alone, where ISIS claimed responsibility for killing people for allegedly engaging in acts of lot, what we might, in a more vernacular way, say engaging in sodomy.
We've got a compelling outright international report after this important message.
Hi, I'm NewsWrap reporter Christopher Gall. It's that time of the year again when many of our U.S. listeners consider ways to maximize their annual charitable tax deductions.
And I'm NewsWrap reporter Chris Ann Eastwood. No matter where you are in the world, we need your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to do your part to keep this nonprofit volunteer-based program going.
You'll also find some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives as our way of saying thank you. And those CDs make unique holiday gifts, too.
Please go to thiswayout.org to support our efforts to inform, entertain, and educate listeners around the world. Or postal mail your contribution to P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
From the This Way Out family to you and yours, happy holidays.
And thank you.
If you want your thank you gift CDs to make it onto Santa's sleigh, please visit our website soon to make your choices. Facing relentless persecution and grisly executions, LGBT Syrians were trying to escape the self-proclaimed Islamic State even before the overwhelming masses of refugees pouring into Europe began making headlines. As many countries struggle with how to handle the humanitarian crisis and the potential security risks, Canada has announced a policy that will include LGBT people among the 25,000 refugees it will accept. Young single men will not be allowed in, but the government of newly elected pro-LGBT Prime Minister Justin Trudeau
perpetrators of violence, then you can't depend on the traditional informal support systems that other refugees have access to. In the context of LGBTI people from Syria, we know that they're depending on other LGBTI Syrian refugees, but we're not talking about a community that's terribly well-resourced in the face of this crisis. When you arrive in a country where you don't speak the language, then other people from your country are going to be incredibly important. It's very often that we see that a refugee crisis is profoundly gendered. We know that if you have savings, that you're in a better position to flee in the face of a crisis than someone who's been destitute all along. So for queer folks, it's particularly important to think about how gender and how location impact us, because we find that not only are lesbians and transgender people often those left behind, but then within the context of being a refugee, the mechanisms for financial survival are very limited for LGBTI people. And of course, sex work becomes one of the key forms of survival for so many.
What are the particular threats that LGBTQ people are facing in places like Syria?
Anyone living under the domination of ISIS is unsafe. It doesn't matter who you are. But obviously, the things that make you unsafe vary depending on who you are. So ISIS has engaged in a systematic campaign of terror, targeting anyone perceived to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or intersex, regardless of who they actually are, what they've actually done, and what evidence does or does not exist to substantiate the allegations of homosexuality or transgenderism. For the past several years, Outright has been working in a very deep partnership with an Iraqi-based organization working primarily on women's rights, and also a U.S.-based women's human rights organization that is a longtime partner of the Iraqi group. And here I'm talking about the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, which is based out of Baghdad, and the organization called Madre, based out of New York. We started looking at the ways that LGBTI people were vulnerable to ISIS through the lens of those living in Iraq. And because of the increasing territorial control of ISIS, we expanded our data to include Syria as well. Based on the last time we updated our numbers, which was mid-September, we had documented over 30 killings in Iraq and Syria in 2015 alone, where ISIS claimed responsibility for killing people for allegedly engaging in acts of lot. So what we might, in a more vernacular way, say engaging in sodomy. And what we've documented, and you can find all of this on our website, outrightinternational.org, is that ISIS has systematically murdered people by pushing them off the rooftops of buildings, by stoning people to death, by shooting people. And more recently, we've been hearing stories from colleagues in Iraq and Syria that some ISIS agents have actually been tying weights around the neck of people they intend to execute for alleged homosexual acts so that they're sure that when they push them off the building, it will be their head that hits the ground first.
Of course, this isn't limited to Syria. It's not limited to Iraq or even ISIS, I would imagine.
Right. When we look at the vulnerabilities affecting LGBTI people around the world, we have to realize that the rise in militia violence makes LGBTI people particularly unsafe. A lot of people are particularly fixated on ISIS, and obviously for good reason, but for those of us that have been trying to work in solidarity with people in Iraq for a long time, what we know is that Iraqi militias were the primary perpetrators of violence against LGBTI people for many years, particularly in very serious and systematic attacks in 2009 and 2012. And in the face of kind of loss of control, the government of Iraq has actually turned to those very same militias to try to help them fight ISIS. So what we're seeing is that whether you're living under ISIS control or you're in some other part of Iraq or Syria where the government is ostensibly in control, the crisis is having a ripple effect that makes LGBTI people at all levels much more unsafe.
From what you're talking about, it's not over for them once they achieve a refugee status, once they even get into a camp or maybe even get into a country like ours. They are still facing real threats to their safety because of their status.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, anti-Muslim, anti-Iraqi, anti-Syrian hate speech that we've been hearing in the U.S. with increasing volume in recent weeks, recent months, has just shocked the conscience. Because instead of fixating on the few examples where there have been violent acts perpetrated by refugees, we should be looking at the overwhelming majority of refugees who are innocent people fleeing gross violence in their home countries and are looking for safety to rebuild their lives. And I'm aware that Representatives Paulus, Maloney, and Sinema, who are also among the leadership of the LGBT Equality Caucus, voted in support of what we'll call the House of Representatives Bill 4038. I refuse to call it by its public name.
I'll say it for you, the American Safe Act.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it is really about safety. I think it's really about hatred and fear. And for people on the American left that remember the environment after September 11th. We know that this country can turn against the people who are most vulnerable, people who are brown, people who are Muslim, people who speak with accents, and we just can't let that happen again. And the scale and scope of the refugee crisis is so tremendous that it is absolutely the responsibility of every one of us that cares about LGBTI people, that cares about human rights, that cares about justice, to make sure that this country is a place of refuge, a place of safety. And we not only accept a decent number of refugees in this country, but we actively encourage them to come here.
A lot of our listeners are probably thinking, well, okay, I agree, this is terrible. I want to do something. I don't know what to do about the Syrian refugee crisis. What can you tell them?
That's a really hard question, because unless you are very committed to this issue, when you ask, what can I do? You generally mean, what can I do in a small amount of time? And I think it's really important to say, that's okay. You don't have to quit your job to make a difference. You don't have to move to Turkey and start working in a refugee camp to make a difference. But you should do something. And there may be a healthy skepticism among some of your listeners about the impact of the congressional process. I want to say, it is in moments like these, after the recent attacks that we've seen around the world, where members of Congress absolutely must hear from us, to hear that we don't want to move into another era of increased state security apparatus and decreased welcome for those in crisis from around the world. So I would say, if you were ever going to call your member of Congress, if you were ever going to write to your congressperson, if you were ever going to sign a petition to someone in Congress, this is the moment.
You are listening to KBOO. Thanks so much for being with us today. We've been playing for you a queer program called This Way Out, national and international queer news. Thanks to all the folks who put This Way Out together. I am Alan. This is the queer slot on KBO Tuesdays from 6 to 7. Each week of the month, we have a different program. I'm here on the second Tuesdays and the fifth Tuesdays when that happens. We're going to hear a reprise of an interview I did last month with Dean Spade. Dean is a trans activist, founder of the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, working on trans issues in New York City, as well as a Seattle resident now. And one of the activists who's working on an anti-pinkwashing campaign, something that's starting to get started here in Portland. So we're going to listen to the first 25 minutes or so of my interview with the amazing Dean Spade. Thanks for listening, folks. Welcome. We have Dean Spade with us here on Preference Radio tonight. Dean is an associate professor at Seattle University School of Law, where he teaches poverty law, administrative law, gender and law, and law and social movements. In 2002, he founded the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. It's a nonprofit collective that provides free legal help to low-income folks and people of color who are trans, intersex, and or gender nonconforming, and it works to build trans resistance rooted in racial and economic justice. Dean is also the author of Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of Law. And Dean is a solidarity activist, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Dean, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dean, to start off, you're in Portland later this week. What's happening with that?
Yes. I'm coming to Portland to speak at Reed I think my talk at Reed is on Thursday at 5 o'clock.
And what's the subject?
I'm going to be talking, the folks on that campus told me they were particularly curious to talk about prison abolition and alternatives to punishment in prison as approaches to dealing with like violence and harm in our communities. So I'll just be talking a bit about those themes.
Wonderful. We'll come back to just those subjects a little bit later. I was talking with Sasha Buchert at the Transgender Law Center yesterday, and we were batting around some of these topics in prep for today's show. I want to start by asking you if there's anything else you want to tell us about who you are.
No, I think that you said some good things. Maybe other things will come out as we go.
Okay, great. So tell us about the Sylvia Rivera Law Project.
Yeah, so SRLP, like you said, is it's basically a poverty law organization, right? Like an organization that provides free legal help to people who are caught up in all these, you know, overlapping systems that target people of color and low-income people, people with disabilities. And basically, I started it in 2002 because I was aware that trans people are especially likely to be caught up in these systems and face like very specific forms of targeting in these systems. For example, a lot of these kinds of spaces are gender segregated or use gender segregation as a way of controlling people. So like homeless shelters are gender segregated, foster care group homes are gender segregated, prisons and jails are gender segregated, so many of these spaces. And in those spaces, trans people face both being placed according to birth gender and being highly targeted, especially with sexual violence and other forms of violence. So, that's kind of one area of, like, particular vulnerability. There's also a lot of vulnerability for trans people because folks are super marginalized from mainstream economies and from non-criminalized work. So a lot of people are living, like, really severely at the margins and often doing criminalized work to get by, which makes people highly likely to, you know, end up in these various systems. There's also issues of trans healthcare not being covered by a lot of different kinds of insurance and Medicaid in a lot of places. So there's sort of these overlapping issues that make trans people very much in need of social services and poverty law related services. But I was also seeing that people weren't getting the help they needed because a lot of the organizations and agencies that are supposed to serve people with these needs, even though those are already like incredibly underfunded, a lot of people aren't getting what they need. Also, those agencies were totally unprepared to deal with trans people. And so I kept hearing stories of trans people having, like, their court-appointed attorney, like, tell them to find Jesus and not return their calls, or people being kicked out of shelters or not allowed to enter domestic violence shelters or drug treatment centers because those places thought trans people would be disruptive or didn't know how to place them or were just outright, like, didn't want them there. So the organization began as an attempt to address that, to kind of look at these poverty law issues, both providing direct poverty law service to people, like actually representing them in some of these situations, and also we do a lot of training of other agencies that that we'd like to see serving these populations better, and so we often like partner with lawyers or other providers to help folks through systems where maybe trans people would have been turned away for services or already had been. And then the other piece of it, obviously, is that our philosophy is that the problems of marginalized populations are not actually solved by just providing, like, these, legal services trying to fight these impossible systems in which you often lose even if you're, trying your best and actually have a lawyer. That's not the solution. That's kind of like trying to meet people right now where they are as best we can. But the solutions come from people building big movements and being, building power with other low-income people, people of color, immigrants, and other marginalized groups to try to change society so that nobody's poor and nobody's, considered illegal and nobody's in a cage. So the other piece of this is that SRLP is plugged into left movements and tries to help trans people be plugged into left movements and tries to articulate why trans politics should be part of and understood by left movements that are trying to end poverty in prison and borders. And so that's, an important part of this as well is mobilizing folks. And one of the things that I noticed is that a lot of movements that are providing vital survival services do that hand-in-hand with providing a space to be politicized and to become politically active. Like, it's hard to be politically active if you can't survive, and it's hard to be politically active if you're really marginalized in the movements that that you would naturally want to be a constituent of. We try to think about having our service. A lot of legal services are not a point of politicization. They're just a point where you either they say, yes, we can take your case, or no, we can't. And so we wanted to create a space where when you come for services in need, someone also says to you, hey, do you want to, this horrible thing is happening to you with your landlord or with the immigration, like, do you want to get together with other folks who are having the same issues and try to, get to the grassroots, solutions to this? And then if folks want to, they can plug in. So it's a different theory of change than kind of typical poverty legal services operates on.
And the Sylvia Rivera Law Project is centered primarily in New York City, is that right?
Yeah, its offices are in New York City, and most of the people it serves are in that region.
Now, in normal life, you talk quite a bit about the dangerous trap of simply pursuing legal equality in our world as a too simplistic and dangerous strategy for marginalized folks. And you pursue a critical trans politics, encouraging the trans activists and their sense of social change to think much more broadly about how to serve the needs of folks who are marginalized or in danger. And there's the idea that mainstream queer politics has fallen into this trap of legal equality. And things have become very simplistic. It's about recognition. It's about achieving certain steps on the way to the rights of normative folks. Can you speak to us a bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I think one of the big mythologies of the United States is that the problems that marginalized people experience can be resolved in law. So we're kind of told all these big stories in the U.S. I mean, I think the most central one we're told is a story about anti-black racism, that it was resolved by legal reforms. So the idea that slavery was resolved by the 13th Amendment, that Jim Crow and U.S. apartheid were resolved by, you know, civil rights laws. And I think that, you know, many of us have a deep understanding that something is very wrong with that story, right? The story that we're a post-racial society, or the story that, you know, gender oppression is no longer an issue because we have laws that say that you can't discriminate against women, or the same story about people with disabilities. I mean, this whole kind of story about how marginalized groups should turn to law, law will then recognize them. The state will, instead of being their oppressor, become their protector, and then those people will be equal. And if then they happen to still be doing the worst in society, well, it must just be because they're lazy or bad. You know, like, that's kind of the bottom line, of other side of that story. And so that story, you know, all kinds of left movements push back against that story. But part of what's important about it is that, you know, for those of us who are living right now, you know, the period when the U.S. started to really, you know, declare people equal and say that racism was illegal and ableism was illegal and sexism was illegal and all of these things, that period, you know, which is something like the last, you know, 40 or 50 years, that's also the period during which, like, material inequality has grown enormously. So during that same period, we've seen, like, you know, wages stagnate, more people working as temps or in the contingent labor force, less people have job security, less people are in a union, you know, the kind of growing wealth and wage gap that the Occupy movement made so visible with the 99% slogan, which is an incredibly racialized and gendered gap. And we've seen also the growth of the largest apparatuses of racialized violence, right? Like this massive prison boom, which is now getting a lot of attention. You know, we've seen immigration imprisonment quadruple since 2001. We've seen this, like, explosion of this privatized warfare system with, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and you know, on and on, and this kind of declaration of this endless war on terror. So it's a little bit iffy to be like, oh, we all became equal, because we've actually become so much less equal, and it starts to look like the declarations of equality are actually kind of papering over, or like a kind of false veneer for, you know, the ongoing explosion of inequality. So, you know, a lot of this analysis I get from reading a body of thinking called critical race theory, which is where people analyzed how the kind of supposed legal wins of the civil rights era have not turned into better access to school, housing, healthcare, and the material needs for black people. And, like, what is it that is tricky about those legal wins that sort of made them undermined or not do what people hoped they would do, or not do what they almost seem like they might do, right? How can our schools be so severely segregated today, you know, so many years after Brown versus Board of Education, and how can our schools at the same time be so deeply unequal so that kids of color still go to the schools that have the least dollars per pupil per year, and white kids still have more resources in their schools? So that whole, I say all of that to say that, you know, then we come to this time where we see the kind of rise of the mainstream lesbian and gay rights formation, and that formation seems to not notice that this is going on, and so then kind of pursue a strategy that primarily is about getting declarations of legal equality, which is just really questionable for those of us who understand the ways in which that has not delivered the goods and has actually been kind of a false narrative for so many groups that have been supposedly declared equal. And so some of the classic things that are problems with that, you know, one is that the concern that it won't provide relief. Obviously, number one, when you have a movement, you want it to, the goal of it is to provide material changes in the lives of people who are experiencing harm or marginalization or poverty. And so obviously we want to fight for things that are going to like actually help our people. Like, that's number one. Another concern is that oftentimes when you fight for these kinds of equality pieces or these, you know, include me in a existing institution like the military or marriage, when you fight for that, you often end up legitimizing that institution, which you know, movements have been trying to tear down or criticize, or even expanding it, right? So you've definitely seen with the lesbian and gay rights formation, the marriage and military are two institutions, like, you know, in extreme crisis. We've had, especially the movements of the 60s and 70s, really exposed both institutions as, you know, fundamentally harmful, racist sites of violence, and you know, longer than that, obviously, the movements against both of those are, you know, date to the times when each of them exist. But you see these institutions in crisis exposed as illegitimate. You know, you see marriage exposed as an unjust way to distribute immigration, healthcare, et cetera. You see a feminist movement that's really exposed it as a site that's been that family violence as a real issue in women's and children's lives, and you know, so much of feminist legal work was about making it easier to get out of marriages, which was a really huge set of victories, and really trying to move people towards greater the ability to be independent from those family ties and not be legally tied to them and stuck in them and noting them as a site of violence. So you see all of that, and then you see how the demand for quote unquote equality in for lesbian gay people in the military and marriage has really kind of rehabilitated those sites. It's kind of been like a propaganda for those institutions. It's like, oh, marriage is about love and family, when we've spent all this time being like, oh no, marriage is actually you know, about racism and colonialism, and it's not about care, it's about forced unpaid labor, right? And you see the military lifted up as like a site of equality and a great job that gays and lesbians should be able to access, when all of our anti-war movements and our feminist movements and our anti-racist and anti-colonial movements have been showing that the U.S. military is terrible for the people in it. It's, you know, there's all this extreme sexual assault and racism inside the U.S. military, and people are traumatized by it, and vets are abandoned by the state, and then that obviously what the U.S. military does around the world is, you know, the bulk of the worst violence we can imagine. So so you see that danger of legitimizing those institutions, and then also as an example of the expansion of those institutions,
out roots around the world to convince folks that Israel is this queer-friendly, safe advance, let's call it liberal democracy, as a way to, I think, both distract attention from Israel's treatment of Palestinians, both within its official borders and without, as well as just summon up support for Israel as a bastion of Western democracy in a troubled, unfriendly part of the world. So it's a public relations campaign that the Israeli government has been partaking in for a few years. They fund film festivals and send out films across, this happens across the U.S., films that are show us, purport to show us that queer lives in Israel are safe and comfortable. The Israeli government helps sponsor trips, queer trips. There's one next spring. It's folks all over the country in the U.S. are invited to participate in this gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans trip to Israel. And the folks, the Jewish community here, the Jewish Community Center folks here in, I'm sorry, it's the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, are participating in this trip. They're inviting queer folks in Portland to participate. And folks on this trip will get to hang out with entertainers and IDF soldiers, Israeli Defense Fund soldiers, and meet the politicians in Israel. The president is one of the folks you can meet with on this trip. So this is something that, a campaign that the Israeli government has put on for a number of years. It draws in more and more metropolitan areas to promote themselves. And it's something that I think isn't good. I mean, it isn't good to use queer people as this wedge to distract attention from what Israel is attempting to accomplish in the creation of an apartheid state that's built on stolen land and ruined lives. You're listening to Preference Radio here on KBOO. We're going to go back and hear a little bit more of my interview with Dean Spade that I had last month.
Crime's laws, right? Hate crime's laws are an example of the way that by claiming inclusion, we actually see the expansion of power of a harmful system. So hate crime's laws are statutes that will expand the penalty if someone is convicted of, harming another on the basis of hate, so based on racism or transphobia or homophobia or whatever. And they also often come with increased financial resources to local law enforcement. So, for those of us who understand that the marginalized communities of the United States are targeted by violence, primarily by the criminal punishment system, it does not make sense to expand the resources of that system when trying to deal with violence. If the number one sort of perpetrator of hate crimes against, for example, trans people in the U.S. is the criminal punishment system itself, police, corrections officers, etc., why would, kind of putting more tools in the toolbox of that system help us, especially since there's no evidence that hate crimes laws prevent violence against us, and instead they provide more money and resources to that system. So that's sort of another danger. And then the third big danger, I think, of equality politics is that it divides groups between the deserving and the undeserving. So when people are seeking to portray a group as, like, deserving equality or deserving rights, it's usually done through portraying them through, like, the classic tropes of who's a deserving subject in the United States. So you start to see, the tropes of whiteness, of able-bodiedness, of quote-unquote hardworkingness, who is considered those who we think should be included into citizenship, and that's who gets kind of trotted out. And oftentimes the legal reforms that happen really only have something that will reach those people. Marriage is a good example, right? It's all about, trotting out perfect, families that look like what we've been told is an acceptable family, knowing that, of course, in our society there's all these incredibly stigmatized family formations and stigmatized people and people punished for having children and people portrayed as, having too many children, all of that. So you trot out those people, and then, the goal, of course, in marriage is to just get the benefits of marriage for people who can benefit from it. And mostly marriage is about sharing privileged statuses, right? So if you are undocumented and so is your date, you're not going to get any documentation. You're not going to get immigration status through marriage. Or if you don't have any health care and your date doesn't either, you're also not going to get health care through marriage. And if you don't have anything to inherit and they don't have anything to inherit, right, you're not going to get it. And most people date and marry inside their own class statuses. And overall in the United States, poor people marry less because they have less to gain from it. So again, you kind of see this the structure where we end up both talking about who's deserving in ways that reify some of the worst, like, stereotypes and kind of controlling images that we'd want to not, reify because they harm people in our communities. And also we just leave behind the people who are most vulnerable. And to me, what movements should do is serve those in the most dire situation first, right? Inevitably, that will benefit the whole group. But if you just serve the people who are kind of the least stigmatized and in the least dire situations, it does not reach the people who are, you know, in prisons and jails, you know, facing deportation charges, you know, living with disabilities, you know, kind of in the most vulnerable situations. And so so for all those reasons, equality politics is really limiting. And when I wrote the book, I was kind of standing at this moment. I was mostly writing in 2008, 2009, and I was watching how trans politics was, like, just beginning to kind of expand in mainstream. Like, there were suddenly more organizations that had funding, and there was beginning to be some, you know, more visibility of the politics in the mainstream media, which now I think has, you know, expanded much more. And I was like, I can see that we're at this crossroads. Like, we can choose this really limited politics that really centers white leadership, that really centers, you know, strategies that are not going to actually reach people who are facing the worst harms. And you know, trans communities are, like, really experiencing these very severe harms of poverty and criminalization and immigration enforcement. And so if we choose these strategies, we're not going to be reaching, like, most people. And I wanted to say to folks, let's please pick another way. Like, let's have a trans politics and a trans practice that's critical and that centers those who are most vulnerable, and that has a racial and economic justice understanding, and that notices that there's lots of other areas of law that should be our focus instead of just trying to get these empty declarations of equality from the state. Why don't we actually ask, like, what is happening to trans people in homeless shelters? What is happening to trans people in criminal punishment systems? Maybe our legal strategies to be more centered on decriminalization or on reducing the power of immigration enforcement. And of course, that whole politics also exists. There's, you know, there's kind of two tracks of trans politics, just like there's two tracks of lesbian and gay politics. And you see the one that's going to be on TV and it's going to be really highly funded and more visible. And then the other, the grassroots racial and economic justice version, that's also very vibrant, but is not, you know, does not make sense to the corporate media, does not get coverage. And so I was just trying to articulate that, that choice that I think stands in front of trans politics, and ask that we be influenced by the lessons learned from movements that have been failed by the legal equality strategy.
Thanks, Dean. The book is Normal Life, Administrative Violence, Critical Trans Politics, and the Limits of the Law. You're listening to Preference Radio, an experiment in queer radio here on KBOO. I'm your host, Alan. We're chatting with Dean Spade. Dean, thanks for being with us. I would love to shift to the conversation and start to talk about solidarity with folks in Palestine and what that's beginning to look like in our part of the world. And I want to say up front that I'm Jewish, and for me, being Jewish is a recognition that my faith is centered around being a minority culture, a minority ethnic group in some larger society, and navigating and negotiating what safety is in that kind of situation, which is a lot of Jewish history. But this, and that's something that I took out of my education in becoming a Jew right from the beginning. You know, it goes back to when I was very little. However, this subject, Palestinian solidarity, is something that I've only begun to think about recently. I invited folks to come who work on this issue locally, and wasn't able to bring anybody else into the conversation this morning, which is sad. A lot of this is fairly new to me, and I'm listening and I'm learning as much as I can. I want to start out by identifying a few things that are happening here in town. The first one that caught my eye is that Portland has a sister city relationship with Ashkelon, which was a Palestinian Arab city until 1948, when the Israeli army moved in and began to clear it, and then constructed the idea of a city named Ashkelon over top of that. There's a sister city association here in town. They've gone so far as to co-host an event earlier this year with Christians United for Israel, which sets up a few flares for me. We also have a Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, which has agreed to help invite folks into a North American trip, North American-wide trip through the Jewish Federation of North America to visit Israel in the spring. And it's a visit where LGBT folks are invited to come to Israel on this specific guided tour for 1 week. It's tagged as See Israel with Pride. Folks who come along pay some good money, get to visit with queer entertainers, with the Israeli president, folks in the Israeli Defense Forces, and have this, you know, this structured tour through Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And then the third thing is that we have a Human Rights Commission that just last month voted to put several companies on the city's Do Not Buy list for their for the city's investment. And these are four companies who are considered to be involved in human rights violations in Israel and Palestine. And there was some dialogue, some heated dialogue around that vote. A couple of folks in the commission changed their votes, but it still passed. And the mayor's announced that he won't honor it at all, that business will go on as usual. And so those are a few of the things that are happening here related to Israel and Palestine. And I know that you have been involved in, let's call it activities to bring light to how our region, how our municipalities are involved in Israel and Palestine.
Yeah.
And so that your work in that in Seattle leads to this film, Pinkwashing Exposed. So let's talk about pinkwashing.
Yeah. Yeah, so the idea of pinkwashing, it's a term that emerged to describe a particular campaign, kind of branding campaign that Israel's been involved in. So basically, you know, for about the last 10 years or more, there's been this movement, it's called